There was a wealthy merchant in London, he had dwelt. He had a lovely daughter, to you the truth I'll tell. Oh, to you the truth I'll tell. She had sweethearts aplenty, and men of high degree, but none but Jackie Frazier could her sweetheart be. Oh, could her sweetheart be? I'll lock you in my dungeon, your body I'll confine, if none but Jackie Frazier can ever suit your mind. Oh, can ever suit your mind. You may lock me in your dungeon, my heart you can't confine, for none but Jackie Frazier can ever suit my mind. Oh, can ever suit my mind. Then Jackie went a-sailing with trouble on his mind, to leave his native country and darling girl behind. Oh, his darling girl behind. She went into a tailor shop and dressed in men's array, then stepped on board a vessel to convey herself away. Oh, to convey herself away. Before you step on board, sir, your name I'd like to know. She smiled all in her countenance, just call me Jackaro. Oh, just call me Jackaro.
Longtime listeners of Wordplay will know that we sometimes range afield to explore other time-based verbal arts besides poetry and the fiction of novels and short stories. Today, we take another foray into the surrounding territory. It was my pleasure last week to sit down with Hendersonville storyteller Karen E. Bain to talk with her about the art of traditional and not-so-traditional storytelling. Here's Karen E. Bain. How did you get into storytelling?
Well, it's been a long road to storytelling, but this is my 10th anniversary of being a storyteller.
10 years.
2009. Good. I told my very first story in public in 1999 in the UK. And the story goes like this. I had been working in the corporate world overseas in the UK for a long time. And I came home to North Carolina to visit my family. And I had a very good friend of mine came down from Tennessee. And we were meeting in her parents' log cabin. And she was telling me that she was finishing up her master's degree in storytelling. And I thought, wow, storytelling.
A master's degree in storytelling.
Yes,
now that's great.
From UT.
From UT. Huh.
And I thought, well, I know about master's degree in folklore, but storytelling. So her husband said, well, show her what you mean. And my friend Heather Nicely sat down with all her family and friends in the living room of this great log cabin down in Tuxedo. And she stood there and told most eloquently the story of the wife of Bath.
Oh, really?
From the Canterbury Tales. And at the end of that story, or throughout the story, the question that's placed on the table to be answered is, what do women want?
Right.
And the answer is to make their own choices. Right. And this story just resonated with me because I was at a time in my life when I'd already done 15, 20 years in the corporate world. I was doing the full 60-hour-a-week life. I had a young child who was about, 6-7 months old. And I really wanted to make my own choices because I felt I was trapped. And also, I was really intrigued by this concept of telling stories. And when I heard Heather, I thought, I could do this. I could do this. But the story, it was the power of the story that really pushed me over. So I kept this in my mind for a year or two. And while I was in London, I took a night course called The Psychology of Stories and Storytelling. And we really looked at the power of how stories affect human beings. And that was step number two on this road. And then later, as I started to make my own choices, I left the corporate world and moved to the Cotswolds. Mm-hmm. And my now late husband came home one day and he said, "Hey, there is a storytelling school up the road. You should go try to get into it." And I was in school doing another study, but I thought I could do this one night a week. And I called up the teacher, who was this marvelous Scottish bloke, and he said that he thought he could get me into the class because they were halfway through and the class had really bonded. And so Alexander McKenzie invited me to come along to the ancient bottom of this old wool mill that he used as a storytelling venue. And the mill had been around about 600 years. Mm-hmm. And I walked in and I went downstairs and sat around the fire. And Alexander told a story in his really wonderful Scottish brogue. And that was it. Mm-hmm. I said, "This is something I'm meant to do." Yeah. And I learned how to tell stories and just haven't stopped.
Mm-hmm. So for you, the story was really empowering. It was even decisive in some way.
Yeah, it was very decisive and very empowering. And the other thing that it did for me that I realized later was that besides planting that seed psychologically, it tapped into sort of the DNA of my heritage. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, coming from the Appalachian Mountains, right. I had grown up being fed and watered on the stories of my family and the stories of the mountains. Right. But I had never actually identified those as valid forms of art.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Until I was 3,000 miles away and right. started to think about it.
See them in a different light.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Having met your mother, I know that she's a great storyteller in herself.
Oh, so, yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, it's really, storytelling is such an ancient art. I imagine we've been telling stories to one another since shortly after, we evolved language. So, that leaves, but nowadays we've got so many different sources of narrative in our lives. I mean, we have storytelling still, we have literary arts and television and movies and many, many sources of narrative entertainment and engagement. What is it that makes storytelling really special, really defines it as a particular form of narrative?
What defines it as a specific art form?
Right.
I guess that the technical answer to that is that storytelling is the oral tradition of telling a story, whether it's a myth, a legend, an epic, mm-hmm. from memory mm-hmm. and not from a script. Mm-hmm. And when I was in the UK, I took some acting lessons, and I was very frustrated because I didn't want to stick to a script. And that's when I started to realize that storytelling was what I wanted to go to. So performance storytelling is always defined by using one's memory to orally perform, mm-hmm. as opposed to reading a story.
Right.
Or doing a reading.
Uh-huh. Mm. Well, yeah. So they're adjacent territories, but it's the use of memory, the fact that there's no script.
Yes.
That defines
yes.
storytelling mm-hmm. itself. Yeah.
And I mean, you were right since, I mean, really even before we had language, because of course all of the cave paintings in the ancient world, mm-hmm. in Spain and France and yeah. all those places tell the story.
Sure. If, depending on whether we had language then.
Yes.
We don't really know.
Yeah, we don't really know. But right. we certainly, had the ability to create that story.
Yeah.
And someone would have at some point used those pictures as a prop, no doubt, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To relate.
For an enactment or a story or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Yeah, it goes way back.
Yeah, it goes way back. And, of course, stories in most of the world were, many stories were used to answer the big questions in life.
Mm-hmm.
Myth, mythology is specifically stories that relate to the creation and human beings, so to explain where we come from and why we are here. And then there are lots of stories of ritual that many cultures use that are told at very specific stages in life. And then the passing on of wisdom and cultural norms, cultural taboos, et cetera. So stories have been with us from the very beginning. And I think one of the reasons that we continue to tell them is because they're memorable, they're transferable, they're entertaining, and they touch our emotions.
Definitely have to touch the heart, right?
And I'm really interested in how the brain works, and the more that I study about the brain, the more I realize how valid storytelling is as a training and teaching method as well, because there are certain parts of the brain that are activated when we imagine pictures, characters, etc., when we're told or read a story. And those images apparently are more ingrained in our brain than if we see them just on a screen. And the other aspect of this is that the brain associates lessons or ideas that come with emotion and holds those associations longer. So even if a teacher, for example, teaches the periodic table in science class, my daughter came home and she was singing the periodic table. And that periodic table song was actually a story. And then she also sang and talked about the story of the scientific process. And I thought, this is brilliant, because the science teacher is using a form of story and emotion to teach facts. And no doubt my daughter will remember that.
She'll never forget her periodic table.
Exactly. And mine is long gone. Mine is long gone.
Well, good. Well, tell us a story.
Tell you a story. Okay. Well, I could tell you a story that is from Swahili, and it's called The Evil Net. And this is a traditional folk story that's told there. But like many traditional stories, they have existed because they speak to us all the time, wherever we are. Well, it appears that there were two men who had been friends for many years, and they were men who had grown up talking about how they wanted to be powerful. And they had come to the conclusion that to be powerful in their culture, they could not be, shall we say, truthful and above board. And one of the men just called himself straight out a sorcerer, and he dealt in the black arts. And he made a bet with his friend that he could deliver more destruction and more evil through his magic than his friend could. Now, his friend said that the only tool that he would use would be his tongue, that that was, in his mind, the ultimate weapon of good or evil. So their bet said that the next time they met, they would determine who had caused the greatest pain. Well, the sorcerer was quite upfront about what he did. He went about his land, and he cast spells, and he made people sick, and he caused pestilence to occur and famine. And people started to die, and the children were dying in their beds, and the old folks were dying, and there was tremendous wailing and grief throughout this country. But in time, as always, time passes as time does, the heartbreak and the grief of losing the people that you love becomes less and less. And there were more children born and more people who became parents, and grandparents appeared. And though they remembered this terrible time when this death had swooped down on them, they returned to normal. Their life returned to normal there. And that happens many times in countries and in places where natural disasters or pestilence, famines occur from time to time. So these people were strong and reclaimed themselves. Now, the friend, shall we call him the liar, who used his tongue, he rose in power through the manipulation of the truth, and he became a very good friend of the Sultan in that area. And he was trusted by the Sultan and by all of the cabinet around the Sultan. And he began to whisper to the Sultan that the Sultan's brother was very jealous of his power and of his resources and would make a move to take them. Now, he only had to suggest this to the Sultan. And then he went into the countryside where the brother lived, completely at peace, without any jealousy or greed in his heart. And he did not go to the brother, but he went to the people who worked around the brother in the countryside. And he began to whisper that the Sultan was going to raise an army. An army to come and take their resources, because he was very greedy and he wanted to make sure that his people would always have access to everything that they needed. So the countryside folk were nervous, and they began to assemble and to create small groups and small armies. And all this young man, the liar, had to do was to report to the Sultan that his brother's people were regrouping for war. And when the Sultan realized this, he did not go to his brother. Instead, he sent his army. And a great, great war ensued, and it went on for years and years and years, and no one was quite clear why it had occurred, but it all seemed to do with greed and resources. And eventually, when the sorcerer and the liar met, the sorcerer had to bow to the liar's power, because the liar had been the most destructive, because he had used two things that human beings always fall victim to, which is greed and hate mixed with rumor.
A great cautionary story.
Yes.
Oh. Well, how did living abroad affect your... Of course, that's where you actually came into your role as a storyteller. And what? How do you think that was different than if you had decided to be a storyteller here in the U.S.? What difference?
Well, to begin with, I living in the U.K., I had a different accent.
Right.
So everybody immediately said, you know, where are you from? And I would say the Appalachian Mountains in North Carolina. And that gave me an automatic niche to be an Appalachian storyteller. Right. Now, you can find an Appalachian storyteller on every corner practically in Hendersonville and Asheville now. But there weren't that many in the UK. In fact, I may have been the only one. But what it did is it opened the door for me to explore my own heritage from a different point of view. And that was the point of view of being 3,000 miles away, but being at the source of where that heritage originated.
Right, because many of our stories, of course, start out as English stories.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I made several road trips to Scotland and to Wales and places like that. And I visited the places where my people came from. And I went to the pubs and I read the books about the people who lived there and their stories. And there were a lot of those stories that came to us in a very traditional manner, slightly changed, but I could see the source of the stories. So the Appalachian, many of our Appalachian stories and our Jacktail stories are just the remake of a story that originated in Scotland or the Celtic Isles or somewhere like that.
Like many of our ballads, our traditional ballads, certainly. Yes.
And there was something very strong about going to Scotland. I know the first time that I made the trip to Scotland, and it truly was a pilgrimage, mm-hmm. because I ended up taking two trains and a ferry and a boat and a bus and all sorts of things over a couple of days. I saw people who looked like my people.
Yeah. And you were Scottish by heritage, aren't
yes,
you?
Yes, yeah. Right. On both sides. Yeah. And I saw people with hands like my grandmother's mm-hmm. and noses like my grandfather. And there was something about the way the people looked at life mm-hmm. that's very similar, of course, to the Scotch-Irish mm-hmm. Appalachian folk who live here now.
Right.
So I was able to explore the original stories from the folk, mm-hmm. from the actual folk that originated them, yeah. and that was terrific.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was terrific.
No doubt, no mm-hmm. doubt, yeah. You're listening to Wordplay on WPVM 103.5 LPFM in Asheville, North Carolina. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Now back to our conversation with storyteller Karen Eve Bain. I noticed when you're telling a story, sometimes you'll draw on traditional material, whether it's from your own tradition or from a different tradition, as in the story you've just told. Sometimes you draw on literary sources, which is a curious loop because, of course, a lot of literary stories start out way back when in the oral tradition, get written.
mm-hmm, yes.
And then you retrieve them as oral, performances. So I think that's really interesting. What other sources for story do you avail yourself of?
Well, certainly, as you said, there's stories and pieces that I read that I've been very inspired by. Mm-hmm. There have been pieces of music that I've heard that I've literally had to pull over on the side of the road if I was driving mm-hmm. and start to write a story that is inspired by that piece of music. And I'm thinking in particular right now, I had a show called Lust in Chocolate that my partner and I were doing. And I was looking for love stories, and I heard a song that Emmylou Harris and Linda Ronstadt did together. And it was just the bare bones of what could become a story. It's just called 1917. And I developed a story about a 15-minute love story from that. So songs have been very influential to me. Ballads, of course, are mountain ballads. And then we have so many wonderful modern ballads that are being produced. And I'm particularly fond of Al Stewart and Nancy Griffith and Mary Chapin Carpenter and people like that. So music has been very powerful for me. And in particular, I grew up here in the mountains, and I grew up in the Southern Baptist tradition and the Independent Baptist tradition. It's fed hymns in my mother's milk, and still there'll be a story that I read or hear, and I'll immediately associate a hymn with it. Mm-hmm. Or vice versa, there are hymns that always have a story attached to it for me from personal experience or something that's been handed down. And then poetry and art have been very influential to me mm-hmm. in creating stories.
Hmm. Interesting, yeah. It's like an ekphrastic story as opposed to the ekphrastic poem, which is the poem written about a work of art, written about a painting or whatever. So that works for storytelling as well.
Yes, there was a great show that I used to listen to every Sunday in the UK on the BBC called Poetry Please. And I had to hear this every Sunday. It was great. And I was really looking forward to the day once a year when they announce the 10 favorite poems in Britain. And I'm not sure if it was the number one or number two, but there was...
They did this every week?
They did it once a year. You got the 10.
Okay.
Once a year, the 10. But every week we had Poetry Please, the show.
Yeah, great.
And so I was just waiting to hear the top 10. And it turned out that there was a poem called Not My Best Side by U.A. Fanthorpe. And it happened that she is a poet who lived in Gloucestershire, the county that I was living in the Cotswolds. And it is a poem inspired by a painting, which was inspired by a story. And St. George is the patron saint of England. Mm-hmm. And St. George is known for killing the dragon and rescuing the maiden.
Right.
And there's many a story that explains that. Well, in the 16th century, an Italian painter, Paolo Uccello, painted this
Saint
scene,
George, right.
Saint George
yes.
and the Dragon. And there's right. there's probably thousands of renditions, mm-hmm. painted renditions of this. But he did this very interesting rendition where the dragon just has three legs and he's very angular, and the maiden is quite thin and she's not very pretty. And then you have St. George who comes in and he's looking a little bit young and he's on a horse that looks completely out of control and too big. And U.A. Fanthorpe then wrote this poem, Not My Best Side, mm-hmm. which is one of the most loved poems in Britain. Hmm. Well, I decided I had to get on a train, go to the National Gallery, and see this painting by Uccello. You know,
yeah.
I was there. I could do it. And it was an amazing painting. And I got a slide of it and several prints. And I came back, and I was working with a woman named Chloe Lees, my other mm-hmm. storytelling partner. Mm-hmm. And I said, Chloe, we just have to do this. We've got to turn this into a proper story. Mm-hmm. And we did. Uh-huh. So we would tell the story, and it's told from the point of view of the horse, the maiden. I'm sorry, the dragon, the maiden, and St. George.
Uh-huh.
And it was a great hit because we satirized it. And then I guess about 3 years ago, just before I left, we were in a literary festival, and U.A. Fanthorpe was going to appear, and we were asked to do this for her. And I was trembling just like the horse was, because it was we weren't doing an exact, you know, verbatim rendition.
Sure.
We had beefed it up,
so to speak.
Yes, so to speak. And I was pretty nervous about insulting her sensibilities about one of the best loved poems, but she loved what we did with it.
Sure, I imagine.
Because yes. I did the whole put on a tiara and do the southern maiden.
The southern maiden.
The southern maiden, yes. And I mean, the poem's delightful. It's mm-hmm. a delightful poem.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, tell us a story.
Tell us a story? Well,
can you do that one, or does that require other voices?
That one requires other voices, mm-hmm. though I could do the poem for you.
Okay.
How about if I...
Sure.
I'll do my best here to read the poem with the vigor that we told it. So you're going to hear first from the dragon, then from the princess, and then from St. George. Not my best side, I'm afraid. The artist didn't give me a chance to pose properly. And as you can see, the poor chap, he had this obsession with triangles. So he left off 2 of my feet. Now, I didn't comment at the time. I mean, what, after all, are 2 feet to a monster? But afterwards, I was sorry for the bad publicity. Why, I said to myself, should my conqueror be so ostentatiously beardless and ride a horse with a deformed neck and square hooves? And why should my victim be so unattractive, so inedible? And why should she have me literally on a string? I mean, I don't mind dying, ritually, since I always rise again. But I should have liked to have had a little more blood to show that they were taking me seriously. It's hard for a girl to be sure if she wants to be rescued. I mean, I quite took to the dragon. It's nice to be liked, if you know what I mean. And he was so physically nice, with his claws and his lovely green skin and his big, long, sexy tail. And the way that he looked at me, oh, he made me feel like he was just ready to eat me. And any girl does like that. So when this boy turned up wearing machinery, well, on a really dangerous horse, to be honest, I didn't quite fancy him at all. I mean, what was he like underneath all that hardware? He could have acne and blackheads and bad breath, and for all I know, he had a teeny tiny little brain. But the dragon, well, you could see all of his equipment at a glance. Still, what could I do? The dragon got himself beaten by the boy, and a girl, well, a girl's got to think of her future. I'm St. George, and I have diplomas in dragon management and virgin reclamation. My horse is the latest model with automatic transmission and built-in obsolescence. My spear is custom-built, and my prototype armor is still on the secret list. You can't do better than me at the moment. I'm qualified, and I'm equipped to the eyebrow. So why are you being so difficult? Don't you want to be killed, or do you want to be rescued? And in the most contemporary way, of course, why don't you carry out your role? That sociology and myth that you've designed for yourself. You don't realize that by being choosy, you are endangering job prospects. In the spear and horse building industry, anyway. What in any case does it matter what you want? You are in my way. So that's a whole new take.
It is.
On St. George the Dragon and the Maiden.
Yes. That's one I haven't heard before. Interesting. And she's a contemporary, I guess.
Yes, she is a contemporary.
Right. Yeah. So I know you also tell stories based on other literary sources. I've heard you do some stories by Jean Genet, Robert Morgan. And, you know, it occurred to me that The Wife of Bath, which your friend told you, is also a literary source.
Yes.
Indeed. Though it lends itself well to oral performance, I would think.
Well, as does lots of the great traditionals like the Iliad, the Odyssey. And
which all began as oral compositions.
Absolutely.
Right. And Beowulf. You know?
One of the big differences that I find being a storyteller here in the United States versus being one overseas is the fact that in our society we are much less able to tell stories that are written by other people because of all of our copyright laws and performance laws and intellectual property laws here. Whereas in the UK, people were not as concerned about that. They were very happy to have their story told if the author was acknowledged. Mm-hmm. And also, we were working with a vast number of historical pieces of literature, many of which were either anonymous or we have lost track of exactly who wrote them, and those folk who rewrote them so that they could be captured for posterity generally were, you know, quite happy to have their version told so long as they were acknowledged. Mm-hmm. And I've discovered here in the U.S. that it is the personal story that is primarily told. Mm-hmm. So at Jonesboro and other storytelling festivals, individuals are capitalizing on their personal experiences.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Which are great. And they're very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's still turning something into a story. It's just right.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like American confessional poetry or something. I mean, it has sort of probably a similar source.
Yes, it does.
Individualism. And, mm-hmm. Yes. Concern for the self, right?
But there's so many stories, as you say, from literary sources that I think still need to be told. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, one of the things that I did in schools in the UK is I retold the Shakespeare stories, which are wonderful,
right?
Wonderful stories. And the language can get in the way, particularly for middle school and high school mm-hmm. kids. Mm-hmm. And I thought that if they learn to love the story first and mm-hmm. understand the story in modern language, that then they might also be able to love the Elizabethan English.
Sure.
And, I mean, even at the moment in Asheville, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, which are taken from mm-hmm. Shakespeare's stories, right. is being produced at the North Carolina Stage Company.
Right.
So obviously those stories need to continue to be told.
Right, and Hamlet's full of them.
Yes, Hamlet's full of them. Right. And I mean, for myself, you mentioned Robert Morgan. People like Robert Morgan, Fred Chappell, have written wonderful stories, particularly about this area that I grew up in, that I found have found to be inspiring and very revealing about the nature of the mountain people. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, Robert has given me permission to use his stories, and I have told his stories quite a few times, and I find them to be very, you know, very rich.
Mm-hmm. Y'all actually grew up a few miles from one another on Green River, as I recall.
Yes, we did. We were 3 or 4 miles apart, and our parents, Robert and I, and our parents went to the same church, same little white Baptist, Green River Baptist Church down there. Robert was enough older than me that he and I didn't cross paths in school very much, mm-hmm. But our parents knew each other and spent a lot of time together. So his experiences of the Green River Valley are very much my experiences. Mm-hmm. And I think the most difficult story I've ever had to tell or chose to tell is one of Robert's stories. And I found it in his book, The Mountains Won't Remember Us. And I was actually in China and I read this book. And there were three stories amongst the short stories that referenced my family mm-hmm. and my people.
Huh. By name.
By name.
Yes.
Yes,
right.
Actually by name.
Colonel Bain.
That's
right.
And there was one story, The Watershed. Mm-hmm. It took me 6 months to get up the nerve to tell that story mm-hmm. because I think it is an incredibly powerful story.
Yeah.
And a story that needs to be told
right.
and to be heard and to be read as many times as possible, because I believe it contains some of the universal truths in any culture at any time. I stand here by the western wall. Maybe a little of that wall stands inside us all. I shove my prayers in the crack. I got nothing to lose, no one to answer back. All these years I brought up for review. Wasn't taught this, but I learned something new. And to answer a distant call at the western wall. I got a heart full of fear, and I offer it up on this altar of tears. Red dust settles deep in my skin. I don't know where it starts and where I begin. A crumbling pile of broken stone. It ain't much, but it might be if I ever loved a place at all. It's the western I don't.
why he found a place to break his fall near the Western.
Listening to Wordplay on WPVM 103.5 LPFM in Asheville, North Carolina. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. And today we're enjoying a little storytelling. Storyteller Karen Eve Bain has been telling us some good stories, old and new. Now we'll get back to our conversation and hear another story. Well, would you like to tell that one?
Well, I could give that one a try. This is, I haven't told this story in a while, and it's told from the point of view of a grandfather or a great-grandfather to his grandson or great-grandson. So I'll do the shortened version for you. Great. Watershed by Robert Morgan. Now, don't you go thinking that those men there, that they was so wicked, those fellers that held you up against that barn wall with the knife to your throat and made you tell you where the silver was. No, they never started out like that. This here war, it's put me in mind of a story I ain't never told nobody's son, so I want you to sit there and listen. But I know you're still a-trembling from what happened to you, 'cause those outliers, they're just regular folk, like your brother and your pa, and they just probably got tired or sick or wounded from this war, and they just slipped back home to the mountains. Now, the home guard's all around, so they couldn't go back to their families proper-like, and that's why they did what they did. And this is what I'll tell you. People don't mean to do some of the things they do. And it's probably a good thing that we don't know what we're capable of doing before we do it. I reckon them fellers, they was just hungry. And first they stole a side of bacon, and then a chicken, and then it was a ham. And then they're slapping some old woman and holding a knife to a boy's throat like yours so you'll tell them where the silver's buried. They didn't start out that way. No, and neither did I. Now, this here story I'm going to tell you, it happened a long time ago when I was about your age. It was when our people was first pouring into this land. It was like pouring molasses and having flies swarming to it. The white folks swarmed into this valley here in Green River, and we set up homesteads fast as we could. And we drove them Cherokee out. And everywhere you looked, there was a little smokestack. White folk settling in, scratching out a living. And in time, there was trouble. Because we knowed that there was some Cherokee that we hadn't run out that still lived up at the headwaters, up at the watershed. Well, it seems like, the story goes as I remember, was that news got round that a few of them Cherokee, they came down there and they caught one of them Jones girls out and they ruined her. Now, Old Man Bain sent word round the valley that every man and boy who could tote a gun and shoot was going to have to meet up there at Cedar Springs Church so we could run them rascals out of the watershed. Well, you see, Mama cried. She said I was too young to go, and Daddy said I could carry a rifle, and I was going to have to go because I had to grow up soon. So we went off in the middle of the night. I just had a biscuit with some tenderloin in it in my pocket, and I had me a rifle I got for Christmas that year. Boy, it was cold. It was November, and we were walking along just as quiet as we could up the Green River Valley. And I kept thinking, watershed, watershed. This word was like, it was like a stone in my mouth that I rolled around and around. And I asked my pa if a watershed was, if it was a bunch of barrels filled with water that we was saving up, and he said no. Well, I knowed it wasn't like a shed that you went out back to. That'd be an outhouse. But Pa said that a watershed was more like a big bowl in the earth that filled up with water, and it fed the streams, and it fed this here river, the Green River that we live off of. And I thought, oh, how beautiful. There's just a bowl, a big, shallow bowl up there. And we will just go up there and we will tip that bowl over. And the Cherokee will just go tumbling down through the waters and they'll be gone. So I walked on feeling pretty good about it. Now, it was quiet. It was real quiet. Well, you could hear a man cough up on the ridge. And I know that there was some folks lived about 4 miles up on top of that mountain. Why, you could hear them up there just as clear as could be, or hear the rattle of a bridle on a horse. The moon was out, and it's one of those cold November nights when everything was frosty. And as we walked along, more men and boys joined us, but nobody said nothing. Now, there was the other Jones boy. He was there, and he was a bit younger than me, and I asked him if he is skeert, and he said he is skeert. But I didn't say I was scared, though I was a trembling inside. As we walked along, it was like being in an Old Testament story. I felt like we were on a march right out of the Bible to do some great good. And as our numbers got larger and larger, we got closer and closer up to the fork there at Bob's Creek in Cedar Springs Church. And that's where old man Bain met us. Now, he got there a little late, and by the time he got there, there was some fellers who'd had a bottle, and they was passing it around. And he told them to stopper that thing up. He said, there's going to be no drinking till this business was done. And everybody did what old man Bain said to do. And so we took off up by the river in the light of the moon. Now, we got up there to a big rock that we still call Prayer Rock, because that's where old man Bain told us we all had to take off our hats. And he said, Lord, give us righteousness and give us strength as we raise our hand to your enemy. Help us to smite them from this earth. Amen. Smite them from this earth? No, I thought, we're just going to tip that watershed bowl over. They're just going to flow out into the gentle waters of the Green River. Smite them from the earth? That's not what I had come up here to do. Now, we walked on, and word got round that we was going to get up to the watershed just before dawn. When we arrived, old man Bain told us to get our rifles loaded and that we ought to be ready to shoot from the shoulder. He said the plan was to sneak up on them, start shooting, and clean them out. Clean them out, I thought. No, we're going to tip them over. They're just going to wash down the river and leave us alone. Now, old man Bain looked at me and he said, boy, I need to count on you. Do you know what you're doing? And I shook my head yes, but I didn't know exactly what he wanted. And then he pointed over to this girl. There was a girl who was tied hands and feet to a tree. Now, she was real dirty, so you couldn't tell if she was a Injun girl or if she was a white girl. And she didn't have much clothes on, and it was the first time in my life I'd ever seen a girl's private parts, so I was looking pretty strongly at this girl. And old man Bain said, you take care of that and over there. And he nodded toward the girl, and I said, yes, sir. So I reckoned that I'd just run down there and cut her loose, let her run off. Well, the shots were fired at these four or five little mud huts, and they just exploded with people. Mainly old people. There might have been three braves, but it was mainly old folk and a couple of babies. And they came running out of there carrying what they had, and them people had nothing. They had nothing. A couple of bolts of cloth, and the braves were taken by surprise, and we shot from our shoulders. Well, they shot from their shoulders. I hadn't done nothing except I run down there to where that girl was, and I raised up my knife because I was going to cut the leather straps that held her together there to the tree. And as I did, she started to spit, and she started to kick, and she kicked mud in my eyes, and I was wiping my face trying to be able to see, and my pa started screaming at me, telling me to get on with that business and get it done, and I was trying to get close enough to where I could cut the leather straps, and then old man Bain ran toward me, and he was saying, get on with it, boy, and I turned to look at him, and just as I did, I saw his face slice away from his skull as a tomahawk came down from behind him, and old man Bain crumpled not 10 feet from me, and I didn't know what to do, and I heard the gun go off, and that brave that had killed old man Bain, his chest exploded right there. Now, Pa was screaming, and I could see that other Jones boy, he was running after this fat little Cherokee woman, and I knowed he didn't want to shoot her in the back. And then finally, just as she got to the woods, she turned around and she throwed something at him. It was a bundle. And just as she throwed it, he pulled his trigger and I saw her chest explode. And then that bundle started to cry. Now, Pa screamed at me to get on with it, and I got closer to the girl with my knife, and she kicked harder and harder, and I had my gun in my hand, and Pa was saying, "Get on with it now, now!" And before I knowed what I'd done, I had pulled the trigger. And she, too, exploded right in front of me. And it was her eyes, her brown Cherokee eyes, that were the last to go down. They locked on me. And I will never forget those eyes. Now, after that, I realized that my leg was stinging. I reckoned I'd gotten shot. We went through. We buried most of the folk. We got what we could. There was nothing much there. Those people was as poor as, well, as Adam's house cat, I reckon. I got a bow and arrow. It smelled real smoky, and I think I gave it to your Pa, who probably still got it out there in the barn. Now, somehow or other, they made a crutch for me, and we put together a sling that we could carry old man Bain's body back in, and we made that great trip down the Green River in broad daylight, carrying what we could. Oh, and everybody thought it was great. They talked about the great success of how we'd run them rascals out of the watershed. They talked about how proud I should be, but I wasn't proud. I never meant to do what I had done. It was not my intention to hurt nobody. I thought we were just going to tip that watershed over. And I never, ever meant to kill that girl. I was going to let her get loose and run into the forest. But at night, a lot of nights, it's still those Cherokee eyes that I see before I go to sleep. And I tell you this, boy, it's a good thing that we don't know what we're capable of doing. Because there's a lot of times we do what we never wanted to do.
Thanks. Yeah, that's such a powerful story.
Thank you. Well, I had heard bits of history growing up on Green River that there had been some Cherokee who lived up there, and they had to be run off. And, of course, I have a different take on it now. But at the time, I'm sure my forefathers thought that this was the thing that they had to do. And I think what's amazing about that story, of course, is that what is right, what seems right to us, is very situational. But Robert took the pieces of stories that had been handed down to him from his father and other people, and then turned it into, you know, a wonderful story.
Yeah, he also grew up in a family of storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
he did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm sailing away, my own true love. I'm sailing away in the morning. Is there something I can sing you from across the sea? From the place where I'll be landing. There's nothing you can send me, my own true love. There is nothing I'm wishing to be owning. Just carry yourself back to me unspoiled. From across that lonesome ocean, oh, but I just thought you might want something fine. Made of silver or of golden. Have it from the mountains of Madrid or from the coast of Barcelona. If I had the stars of the darkest night and the diamonds from the deepest ocean, I'd forsake them all for your sweet kiss. That's all I wish to be on.
And you're listening to Wordplay on WPDM 103.5 LP FM Asheville, North Carolina. And I'm your host, Jeff Davis. And today we've been listening to some stories told by Hendersonville storyteller Karen E. Bain. Now let's go ahead and wrap up the conversation that Karen Eve and I had. Well, word has it that you're actually organizing a storytelling festival for this summer.
I am doing my best to do that. We're going to have a storytelling festival in downtown Hendersonville. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be in the old historic courthouse.
Yeah.
July 11th.
Right.
The afternoon of July 11th. And that happens to also be the 100th anniversary of 4-H in Henderson County. So I'm marrying this up with some 4-H activities, and we'll have some kids out front doing demonstrations of all sorts of things. And then inside, we're going to have four or five storytellers. We're going to have an Abraham Lincoln teller, uh-huh, Candler Willis, who is excellent. Of course, what better year than this year to celebrate Lincoln's 200th birthday?
Right.
Hopefully Bad Hair Williams, Henderson County storyteller, will be there. And then also Heather Nicely, the woman who introduced me to storytelling, will come down from Tennessee, mm-hmm, to do some of her storytelling, and I'll do some as well. And then we have, as you know, you're helping me out by bringing in some Western North Carolina poets.
Right.
And our goal is to have some poets and storytellers around town as well.
Yes.
So at the moment, we're looking at having those at the Black Bear Coffee Shop, mm-hmm, the Picasso Patisseria, and then the Living Room Coffee Shop, mm-hmm, in the evening. So I'm hoping that folks will come in for the afternoon and the evening to downtown Hendersonville on July 11th.
Sounds like it'll be a lot of fun.
Well, we're calling it Do Tell, and I hope it will be a lot of fun.
Well, I'm sure it will be. Well, thanks so much for telling us some stories.
You're very welcome. It's always great to share a few.
Wordplay for this week. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Thanks to Karen E. Bain for telling us some stories. You'll often find more information about Wordplay shows on naturespoetry.blogspot.com. So check that out.